Well, good morning, everybody. I told Kevin when I put this mic on, it felt a little weird again because I haven't done that in a long time. But it also felt a little familiar. And I'll tell you why here in just a minute when I show a picture or two. Thanks for the opportunity to share my pandemic story and reflections, I think. It's not an easy space to occupy for me. It's a lot easier when I sit here and we talk about something that's certainly more thematic for all of us. Not that the COVID pandemic isn't, but me kind of opening this part and letting some things out is harder for me. It's way easier for me to sit and let you do that with me. So I'm John Ellison, if I haven't met you or gotten to know you well yet, former associate minister here at East County from June 2001 until January 2009. At that time, we moved to Springfield, Missouri. I did my Bachelor of Science in Nursing degree and graduated in May 2010, and then started working as a registered nurse in emergency trauma and did that for 3 years. During that time, with very little boys, and Stephanie working a terrible job that stressed her out beyond belief, as a secretary in the neurology department, I did my Master of Science in Nursing family nurse practitioner degree and graduated in May of 2013. And as you know, at that point, we moved back to Portland, which many of you have told me you thought would never, ever happen. There's some things I could say about why we didn't want to stay where we were, but that's a different story. I started first as a nurse practitioner, just not too far down the road at Adventist Rockwood Urgent Care. Was there for 4 years. And then I went to Kaiser Permanente for a year and a half. I did cross cover, like scheduled urgent care is what they told me. Dan knows how this goes. For about a year and a half, and then to Mount Talbert Urgent Care over on the Sunnyside campus. About a little over a year ago, I took a position with Providence, and I'm now an immediate care nurse practitioner, and I float to all the different clinics in our metro area, which provides a lot of interesting exposure to different groups and populations and peoples. I'm in my 10th year of being a nurse practitioner in urgent care. And 13 years total in medicine, which seems unbelievable to me. If you've ever been to urgent care, hopefully you haven't, but probably have, I'm the provider or the doctor that everyone sees. Luckily, I'm not the only one there on any given day. I diagnose, order blood tests, x-rays, CT scans, rarely MRIs, thankfully. Heart monitors, heart testing, ultrasounds, write prescriptions, place referrals to specialists, physical therapy, occupational medicine if you have a work injury, sew up your lacerations, cut open those nasty things that show up on your skin. Is John not here? Darn it. Well, maybe we'll get into some things he won't like. Yeah, is he in the floor? I've lost my place, and so on. So many other things. It's a busy, sometimes crazy setting. Most of the time, it's crazy. I have more stories than I have time to tell. Probably some things that John and others of you don't want to hear or know about, and others of you right now are just itching for the gore, which always makes fun for party conversations. But COVID has had a tremendous impact on healthcare, the practice of medicine, our world, and on me personally. also in more ways than we have time to talk about. In the course of my training, we prepare and learn and study so many things, but none of it seemed to prepare me for this last 2.5 years and what we experienced. And true for my colleagues, for you, and for so many people in our world overall. And here we are 2.5 years later, getting ready to enter our third COVID winter. I don't know if you've heard that term yet, but it's out there. And anticipating another likely surge and rise in cases at any time, if you look at the rest of the world and the pattern that has occurred before us. When Kevin asked me to talk about this, it's interesting to think about a pandemic story because for me, it's still a pandemic. It's still with us. It's still happening. And I'm reminded of it every day with multiple patients a day. Personally, I'm high risk. I have Crohn's disease, which is an inflammatory bowel disease. And I'm on an immune modulating, compromising medication. And I work in a terribly high risk setting. It's interesting to hear some people kind of early on and mid, they would into the pandemic, they would say, oh, well, we came here because we didn't want to go to the emergency room because there might be people with COVID there. And I kind of had to bite my tongue. And there's actually some really great things about having to wear a mask all the time. Because it covers this part of my facial reaction. It doesn't do a good job here. But I would have to not say things like, well, the person who was in this room right before you had COVID. One month ago, Stephanie and I finally had our first COVID infection. And it seemed inevitable. Like it was coming at some point. We had dodged it for so long. And I'm grateful that it took this long because some of the earlier variants were much more serious and severe. And the current Omicron variant tends to be that way even for some now. Two days after Kevin invited me to do this, I was hit again with my mom and her housemate being positive for COVID for the first time. And they are both very high risk. Thankfully, they're recovering well. I'm not sure she would tell me if she wasn't. But from what it sounds like, things are okay. But it was one of those things that I feared greatly along the way. And interesting, even though we're this far into it and still what feels like in the heart of it to me, many people, go on giving pretty minimal attention to it and have little concern. At least many that I see in the exam room coming in for things that they wouldn't immediately ascribe to COVID-like illness. But I'll come back to that more in just a bit. Most people are over it. They're weary, they're desensitized, and some people are even numb to it. It reminds me of the lack of the reaction that we have to mass shootings in our country. Still very much with us. Will you put up the first slide? This is probably a year into it-ish. I sent this picture to Stephanie to show one day. Hey, I think I finally found a configuration that I can live with. So This is actually probably a tier one mask, which is not very protective, but it's what we had early on. In the first probably year to year and a half, this was when I was at Kaiser Urgent Care, we did not have enough N95s to wear at any time. We had a few, but you had to have very specific criteria in which to wear them. We were required to wear some type of eye protection, even if we had glasses, just for the potential fluid exposure, though now it seems silly because there is some amount of airborne component. And then I put that hat on thinking maybe the hat will absorb something, and then I, you know, who knows? And then I have not worn, I have worn gloves in every exam room with every patient without fail since before, right at the time COVID began. We didn't do that before. I don't know if you have memory of going to the doctor, and people didn't do that. They didn't, if you were hacking and sputtering and all that, they might put a mask on. Sometimes we didn't even do that. I walked across the nurse station just a month or so ago. I had a face shield on, which I'm not wearing in that picture, but I would have had on in front of all that stuff. And I guess I had just taken a bite of something or taken a drink and had not put my mask back on. I walked all the way across. I got to the room, and one of my medical assistants, I saw him go, this face. And I got to the door and I thought, what was that? And I was like, I don't have my mask on. It's just amazing to think that we just didn't do that before. Yeah, yeah. Go ahead and go to the next one, please. They told us we couldn't take our masks off for any reason. So this is trying to like take a bite of something or get a drink of something. This is also when the strap gets tangled up in all of the headgear and you can't, you know, and I don't know about you, but sneezing into a mask is one of the most disgusting things. So that's usually when the tangle would occur, is trying to rapidly, it doesn't work. Go ahead and do the next one. When I moved to Providence this last year, it was right in the heart of the beginning of Omicron and the surge that was occurring. And there was one day that I saw, oh, I don't know, probably 26 patients that day, and 18 were positive for COVID. So this is called a capper, which is a continuous airway pressure respirator. So instead of having to wear like the whole hazmat suit, luckily they have something like this. It's a really cool device, actually. It filters the air. It has this clear face shield. It comes down to here. It has a battery pack that I wear in this pocket in the front of my scrubs, which feels a lot like this thing on me right now. And it has a cable that connects to the back that the battery pack powers the fan, which filters through this really dense filter in the top and blows the air in the front, which I can breathe cleaner air. And then it goes out the sides along over the ears. So it's open there. My glasses do not fog up because of the fan and the movement of air. It evokes a lot of different reactions in the exam room. Some people are like enthralled. They just can't stop staring at it. And they want one. And where do I get one? And I'm like, I don't know. They just have them here for me. I wore an N95 under it for a while. Now I just wear the tier three mask. And then the gown, and then the gloves. And faithfully, every time, if I even see on the notes that I might be going in a room where someone has any type of symptom because of my risk. Go to the next one. Okay, yeah. So just to demonstrate very much with this, this is a site from Johns Hopkins University, their Coronavirus Resource Center, and I lived and died by this page for months, especially in the early days of the pandemic. I remember the spot that I sat in where at Kaiser Urgent Care, we would have 3-4 hour waits, and then suddenly nothing. There were days in the first month to even 3 months where we would have single digit numbers of patients check in for the 10 hour day. It was unheard of. We didn't know what to do. And so I sat and watched these numbers move some days. And I read and I tried to figure out what in the world are we doing. Total number of cases in red since it began as of yesterday, almost 625 million cases and 6.5 million deaths in the world. They've updated this page several times, and you can get into the weeds with data if you want. But down the left-hand column, it shows a 28-day case count and death count for different countries. 12-day cases in the world, 12.8 million cases in the last 28 days. In our country, 1.2 million. And still, 11,403 deaths. Go to the next one. This is the Oregon Health Authority page. Another one that I read constantly. And it's evolved to be easier to use now as well. In the first 18 months, I got an email every day from the Oregon Health Authority that I signed up for that showed cases counts, vaccinations, deaths, you name it, and then trends. This is in the last week, 3,700 new cases just in Oregon. Total cases in Oregon, 900,000. 32 deaths in the last week, which isn't bad. And 8,600 total in our state since it began. Next one. The top one's vaccinations. It looks good. 85% of people in the state over 18 have had one dose, which one dose is better than no dose, but it's not enough. And then the test positivity rate is something that I still watch very closely. And the reason for that is it gives me an idea of the trend of what's happening in our community. At one point, we were up to around 30% of tests were positive, which may not seem like a lot to you, but it's a lot. And now this number is even a little bit, I'd say, skewed low, because how many of you have a test kit in your home? How many of you report that result when you take a test? Can I take the test? I should have known, Kevin. We didn't even do that because I couldn't figure out how to do it. When the boys tested positive Evan January 1st and then Eli January 8th, I tried to do it and couldn't figure it out. Go to the next slide. This one is hard to talk about a little bit because we can get too detailed, but the point of it is these are the approved, most emergency use approved treatments for the disease of COVID-19. The first one isn't even really a treatment. It's a preventative treatment called Evusheld. How many of you have heard of that? You have, because I've talked about it with you. I would encourage you to learn more about it. And if you want to ask me questions about it outside of this, I'm willing to talk to you. Evusheld is a monoclonal antibody treatment that provides protection against acquiring the disease. It's 2 injections. It's good for about 6 months. And I had that in June. And I think it made my case a month ago less severe because Stephanie was sicker than I was. She had it first, though, and gave it to me. Injectable treatments, remdesivir, and then I don't even know how to say the other one because I don't deal with it because it's given usually in the hospital or an outpatient treatment center. So is remdesivir. And then the 2 oral treatments, one which I'm sure you've heard of, Paxlovid, and the other is called molnupiravir. So if my count is right, there's actually 4 treatments. One is preventative, so it makes 5. Next slide. This just talks about monoclonal antibodies. You can keep going. That one was really more for me. Here's the thing about the treatments. You've heard about them, and you've heard everybody should get them, and everybody can get them. But everybody can't get them. And there's a variety of reasons for that. Some are about the vulnerabilities that I want to talk about here in a minute. But for some of them, there's very specific parameters in which they can be taken safely. For molnupiravir, you have to be 18 or over. And it actually has very minimal interactions with other medications, which seems to make it a very attractive option, except that the studies show that it helps reduce likelihood of severe disease and hospitalization by about maybe 40%, which doesn't really meet a lot of criteria for being super effective. Paxlovid, much better efficacy rate. I mean, you have probably 80 to 90% chance of avoiding really severe illness, hospitalization, or death with vaccination and use. You have to be older than 12, but there is a list of medications that if you're on, you cannot have that drug and take it safely. How many of you know that? Dan. It's always the Dans. If you have severe liver or kidney disease, even if it's not severe, if your kidneys are not filtering at the right rate, it's not safe for you to have that. Allergy to one of the ingredients, well, that's obvious, but or poorly controlled HIV infections, then you're not eligible. But the medication risks are so high given what you might already be taking. These slides don't include vaccines, which we watch the development of that from the inside like hawks. And every one of us that were able to get it as early as we could have pictures of us getting it and sharing those pictures with one another because it felt like a lifeline. We would have vaccination clinics at our site at Mount Talbert. And at the end of the day, if they had opened a vial and there was a dose or two left, we didn't want to waste it. And so we would call people to come and get it, even if they weren't even eligible to get it yet, because we didn't want to waste it so bad. Yeah, because we couldn't store it once it was open. And I can't emphasize enough how the vaccines have played such a tremendous role in reducing that severity of disease and dramatically reducing the likelihood that you end up in the hospital or dying. Next one, please. This is about long COVID, which, sorry. Can you go one more? I may have put them in out of, I didn't make that slide. That's what happens when you do this really late at night. There's an article synopsis that I had 4 days ago that talked about long COVID, which is very concerning to me. And I'll just read this. This is from the WHO Director General. He wrote, long COVID causes prolonged suffering, has devastated the lives of tens of millions of people, and is wreaking havoc on healthcare systems and economies. A large study in Scotland found about 5% of COVID-19 patients have not recovered within 6 to 18 months. 42% have only recovered partially, and even people who are asymptomatic may experience long COVID symptoms. Somebody with their phone calculator want to do the math? I didn't do this. Give me 5% of 650 million. I don't even know if we need a number. 5%. Yeah. What? 39 million with long COVID symptoms. And if you've had the disease, imagine having symptoms for an additional 6 to 18 months, not being able to go to work, not being able to, for some, walk across their home because of the way they breathe. It's worrisome. It, in articles, it's listed as what will likely be the greatest cause of disability claims in our country for years and years to come. So I put together like three reflections, and we're never going to get through them all, in addition to what I've already shared. And I think I'll just list them out, and then maybe we'll do a choose your own adventure and let you pick which one you want to hear about. The first one, I think a lot about just how much we don't know. I mean, there's a lot that we've figured out. There's a lot that we're learning about, but there's an unbelievable amount of things that we just don't know. The second one is, throughout the pandemic, just with my own health and body, but in interacting with patients day in and day out and hearing their stories, especially those that were very sick and in the hospital for what I cannot imagine amounts of time. This reflection of seeing our bodies and our lives so much more honestly, about being limited, and about how we fight that in every way possible. And then the third one is just the impacts that COVID has had on some of the most vulnerable people and populations around us. Any two? Wendy says two and nobody else moved, so that's where we go. I want to say one thing real quick about the first one, just about how much we don't know. The slide that's up there, the reason I put that there is there is so, even in the midst of how much we know, the amount of information out there is astonishing. I can't keep up. I can't read it all. I try to read as much as I can. I'll work 10, 11, 12, 13 hours in one shift. Last week, one day was 15, and come home and sit and read and read and read. Sometimes I can't turn it off because I want to know more. I want to learn more. I want to be able to bring something to the table in the room with the person that I'm with. And oftentimes it feels so lacking. One of the very best resources that we use is called Up to Date. What a name, right? It's up to date because nobody wants out of date information. It's an incredible website. It costs a lot of money, and thankfully almost every hospital system pays for it. I got this message About 5 days ago. This is just a little blurb at the very bottom. I get this message every 2 weeks, and they highlight three things they've updated in the last 2 weeks. They say this: up-to-date expert contributors continuously monitor more than 425 medical journals, so you can trust up-to-date is always current. Since September 28, 2022, which was 2 weeks before I got the message, 651 different entries have been updated, added, including 17 what's new entries. I don't know what they are, and they don't tell me. I'm sure if I got on their site and clicked on, you know, what's new or what have you updated, they would list it out, but there's no time for that. It's just, it's overwhelming for me to think about how much I can't keep up, how much I don't know. Okay, so let's go to the one Wendy selected. Yeah, go ahead. At times, I mean, if it feels particularly pertinent to something going on, we may get an update from leadership somehow. A lot of times you just discover it on your own. They don't have time either. So this reflection about seeing our lives and our bodies more honestly, I struggle in the exam room often with the interactions I have with people when we talk about health and disease and our bodies. And part of it is there's so much happening in any one moment inside of each one of us. It's complex. There's this rhythm of life and death with the cells, with your bones, with everything. The bones you have now, you did not have, I don't know, a year ago? They're completely remade. The cells in your body are constantly turning over. They're not the same. And it's really intricate and amazing to think about it. It's wonderful, but it's also fraught with terrible risk. But to even bring up the subject or talk about it in a setting like this, even among you who are safe, and like preaching to the choir, so to speak, we don't like to talk about our limitations, our own mortality. But the truth of it is we're always moving towards breaking down. There's lots of things we can do along the way to try to make a difference about that. We can ease it, we can slow it, we can prolong things. And some of those are good and worth doing, to be sure. But some of them are not. And that raises some really hard questions that seem to me to be where we struggle in our time of rapid technological advancement in the last 20 years. Why are we doing this? What drives it? Is it fear? Is it desperation to be what we were before somehow? Or to avoid something that we fear? And there's all kinds of things we can do, but I often wonder, should we? And have we really thought through the implications that come with taking certain paths and steps? Not many are very patient to sit and have that conversation, particularly not in an urgent care setting where you have anywhere from 10 to 15 minutes in theory, because that's how we're measured almost. Some people deny it altogether, but this is just not happening. We all know better than that. But some people become very fatalistic. It becomes who they are. Your disease becomes your identity. I think we all know people who come to mind when I say that. And that hurts when I hear it and see it. And they don't say it like that, but it comes out as, well, you know, this is kind of interesting. I'm not sure what's going on, which is part of the one I didn't talk about. It's not a very popular statement in the exam room. But they will say next, but well, if it's going to be weird and if it's going to be terrible, it's going to be me. It hurts to think that people come to that place when they think about their life and their health and their body. We're not machines. Though so many of the words that we use and the things that I hear are described in that way. I wrote this, healing takes time. It can be slow. It can be poor. It can be incomplete, difficult, challenging. It can require effort, which isn't always popular, and behavior change. And I feel like our culture has very poorly equipped us to handle this and to do that well. We live in a culture of now, immediacy, instant gratification, entitlement of same day Amazon delivery, 1 hour photo or less. I mean, I work in immediate care, which rarely is. And we all know it, but the expectation is, why have I been waiting so long? I want to see you sooner, I guarantee it. But I can't run past the person in front of you to get to you and then take the time you want without doing that for them. We've adopted words in medicine for machines: fix, repair, replace. Sometimes we can do that. I mean, Dan's a walking bionic man. But it doesn't always work that way. Bodies and minds heal with time and support and nutrition and rest and movement and care. It takes patience and time, even in those parts we replace, right, Dan? And it leads me to the kind of the real heart of this point, Wendy, is that there's this really difficult tension and dynamic between curing something and managing something. And most people I see, they want it cured and fixed, and they want it now or as fast as possible because I don't want to have to deal with this anymore. And I get it. I have those things myself. But it doesn't really work that way. Most things, many diseases and conditions, we end up trying to manage. And some of that, because of how much we don't know, we still don't do well. Sometimes it feels like this giant game of trial and error. And that takes patience and a willingness on both sides to even entertain that. And that's challenging. I don't know how many blood pressure medicines there are. There's probably 6 different classes of medications. There's probably 40 or so. Some research has identified what will work better for some people and people groups and ethnic groups than others. And some of that research is even being questioned. And so to start someone on something that they didn't want in the first place and are trying to get rid of, to say, we're going to try this first and see how it goes. And if it's not working well, we'll try something else, is mind-boggling to them. Why can't you just fix this? And usually my answer is, if I could, I would. And if I could, you would never have met me. I'm just so struck by how many of us, myself included, are so poorly prepared to handle and to cope with chronic disease and health. There is not a single day, a single shift that goes by where I don't hear at least once, usually 3-4 times, from older adults or those with chronic diseases, boy, you better not get any older, because it's just not worth it. Or it's just not all it's cracked up to be. It's not for the weak. And some of those are in jest, and some of them are with heartfelt grief. But some of the greatest encounters that I have experienced are those with patients who, that thing is driving me crazy, with those who have somehow found a way to live in spite of, and maybe not even in spite of, in the midst of what they have going on in their body or their mind, and they have embraced enough to live in a way that they still flourish and they still live. I felt like that this past Sunday when I talked to Bill Hunt. It was remarkable to know how much someone suffers and lives with uncertainty and unknown, and in the midst of it still feels some type of joy and hope and goodness about their life. And that's a gift. That's a grace. But it's not common. And COVID has forced me to deal with that in ways that, I mean, I live with that all the time, but it's here now, all the time for me. There was a patient I saw in Sherwood that I really couldn't do anything for. She had had COVID. She was in the hospital 3 months. She was on a ventilator for 2 months. When she woke up, they were amazed. She was told by specialist after specialist that they didn't know why she was alive. And she still did not look great. But she had brought herself in to try to find some way to deal with one thing that was still happening months and months later. But to hear her tell her story, she was still living. And not just waking up and then going to bed and being awake during the day. She was living as fully as she possibly could. And so that's one major thing that I think about a lot. There's a lot about the vulnerabilities of people in our communities and world because of COVID. And I'm just going to run through it fast. The racial disparities are terribly sickening. And for Black and Hispanic populations, it's taken nearly 2 years for the gap to close to become even close to the amount of death that's occurred in white Americans. Those that are undereducated, less educated, poor, that are not able to work from home, that are not able to sit and read and try to figure out how to protect themselves, who are trying to day to day survive, feed their families, keep their housing. It made the tag of essential worker that was placed on me feel very uncomfortable, because I passed essential workers on the road that stand at cash registers and work in service industries that were terribly unprotected compared to what I was, even with the minimal supplies that I was given. And it just felt, well, icky. And then those that are in poor health, disabled and older adults, those that are vulnerable in our society, the concern for those individuals and populations has been lacking because of my own individual freedom and rights to do what I would like. And just to be a member of our human community, hearing patients in the exam room completely reject the need to be sensitive to people that are vulnerable was and continues to be very, very troubling. I'd like to say there's been some joys along the way, being home with my family, sharing in times together that we might not otherwise. But overall, this has been a tremendous heaviness on my heart. I grieve what's happening around us to those that are vulnerable, to the amount of certainty that people feel like they need in order to avoid the unknown and move forward in their life. But what does give me hope, seeing some of my incredible coworkers give those extra touches to patients, my beloveds, Stephanie and Eli and Evan, and then you. The ways that I see you and we as East County try to care for those who are vulnerable, for the least of these in our midst, for those in our parish. You are a grace, a light, and a balm for this heavy and weary heart. There's a lot more in here. I have one short PSA, okay? And I have the mic, so I guess I'm just gonna take it. I cannot emphasize, urge, plead any more strongly in this moment than this. Please, please get your flu shot and do it now. We've stayed away from each other for the most part for 2.5 to 3 years, and we are already seeing it show up, and it could be bad. I know we said that last year and it wasn't, but other areas of the world have been ravaged by it so far. And then second, get your COVID vaccine. If you haven't and you can't, then think about getting the Evusheld shot. If you have questions and you want to talk about it more, I'm open. If it's been more than 6 months since you had a COVID shot, or if it's been 3 months since you had COVID, you can do it now. And I think you should. I have to wait now. I plan to do it, in about 3 weeks, but that's not happening. And just one last statistic to try to emphasize the point. On the 11th of this month, there were still 400 Americans or so dying every day from COVID-19. But the risk of death is close to zero, and I mean really close to zero, if you're up to date on your vaccine and you get treatment that you're eligible for when you get sick. Thanks for letting me share. I would like to have shared more stories and things, but there's just too much. But thank you. I appreciate it.